Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Winning Mr. Wrong by C.W. Farnsworth. Narrated by Ada Sinclair and Tyler Dunn. 1. Embry.
Boo!
I cut my hands around my mouth to achieve optimum volume.
Learn how to throw a ball, Hastings!
Really, My brother Jeremy sighs from his seat beside me as he munches on overpriced popcorn. How do I know it's overpriced? Because he spent the entire second quarter telling me so.
For what they charge. The salt-to-kernel ratio is all wrong.
Luckily, I learned how to tune out Jeremy's babble years ago, early adolescence, to be specific. His fiancée, Amy, is the one who has to put up with his long-winded complaints now. I'm certain she'll be hearing plenty of commentary on inflated food and beverage prices at sporting events when he gets home. Luckily, my brother is engaged to a woman with the patience of a saint, an important, impressive one who has to deal with trying circumstances on a regular basis yet remains serene. I don't think anyone would say the same about me. Hair trigger temper is a phrase that's been used more than once. I prefer passionate. The prices charged inside Inglewood Stadium, home to the Chicago Grizzlies, are ridiculous. But when you have the market cornered, or customers trapped inside a ginormous stadium with no way to smuggle snacks in, you can charge $10 for a bucket filled with oversalted corn kernels. Simple supply and demand. My business knowledge is limited to what my college boyfriend spewed when he was trying to appear intellectual, but that seems about as foolproof as a marketing strategy can be. Then again, Ian has yet to be featured in Forbes. Last I knew, he was working out of his parents' garage. The Grizzlies' quarterback throws another interception. I grab a handful of Jeremy's oversalted popcorn and chuck it toward the field. Unfortunately, we're several hundred feet above it. Up in the nosebleeds, that only cost three figures apiece, not four. Meaning the players on the field don't notice. Just the people two rows down from us. I take a sip of my beer when they glance back, annoyed. No popcorn to see back here, folks.
Yeah, your aim is so much better,
Jeremy states dryly. Shut up, I tell him, drinking more beer.
Slow down on that. I'm not buying you another one.
I'm not going to get drunk. Trust me, it'd take a lot more than this. I sound prouder of that fact than I should, but I'm 25 and constantly second-guessing my life decisions. A glass of wine, or three, when I walk into my cramped, quiet apartment and kick off my heels at the end of a long day isn't too much to ask for, is it? Jeremy thinks so.
It's worrying your alcohol tolerance is that high.
At least I'm a fun drunk, I reply, taking another sip. A demeaning, incredulous scoff that could only be produced by an older sibling sounds to my left.
Who told you that?
People, I respond vaguely, because that might have been a self-sourced observation.
You're a messy drunk, Jeremy informs me. Remember my senior year homecoming?
I flush. Unfortunately, I do. An evening that started out with humiliating myself in front of Jason Mitchell and ended with burning brownies in the home economics room. The details between those two events are still hazy, thanks to the contents of Sadie Johnson's parents' liquor cabinet. I'm 25, not 15. I can handle more than one drink, Jeremy.
When they're charging $15 for a domestic, that's outrageous.
And we're back to concession stand prices. I'm tempted to tell Jeremy he's being ridiculous, but I refrain. We grew up on a shoestring budget, and spending money unnecessarily is a foreign concept to both of us. I could get five bottles of wine from Trader Joe's for $15. I'll liquor up in the parking lot before the game next year, I decide.
We don't have to keep coming, Embry,
Jeremy tells me. His quiet, soft tone is a stark contrast to the pandemonium surrounding us. The shouts, the announcements, the suggestive comments aimed at the man who can't manage to find his receivers.
I want to, I insist.
Calling me a sports fan is a stretch. I grew up in Chicago, though, with a father who would consider being called simply a sports fan an insult. He's a fanatic, an aficionado. He worships at the altar of game day commentary and limited edition jerseys. I can sit through one football game. For him.
Jeremy nods, then abruptly changes the subject.
Amy asked me to see if you want to come over for dinner on Thursday night.
Warm invitation, I drone. If not for Amy, I would probably only see my brother on holidays. He's loyal and thoughtful and loves to dish out tough love. We couldn't be more different. But I know he would move mountains for me if need be. Here's hoping he doesn't have to, because I would never hear the end of it. But I can't. I have a date.
A date? On a Thursday?
He sounds scandalized. People date all days of the week, Jeremy, I reply loftily. Not surprising you don't know that since you haven't been single in over a decade. Jeremy and Amy are in the tiny, minuscule minority of middle school romantic relationships that survive the long trek from puberty to adulthood.
Fine, fine, he interrupts. Just, where did you meet this guy?
I slouch in my seat and stare down at the field. Play has paused again. Why do you have to say it like that?
Like what?
Like you're expecting me to say it was a poetry slam or a grocery store.
Wasn't Jacques the guy you met at a book signing?
Yes.
I rest my case.
I sigh. My type when it comes to men tends to be work in progress. The guy's on the cusp of becoming something, with big ideas and minimal follow-through. All of them have had traits revealed that made hanging in there until the becoming something stage came about highly undesirable. Jacques was my latest boyfriend. French, artsy, and mysterious. We met at an indie bookstore, had our first date at a gallery, and would walk around the city for hours talking about New Yorker articles. Unfortunately, I learned the reason we spent so much time wandering the streets of Chicago was because his residence was a closet. I'm not exaggerating. A literal closet, barely large enough to fit the twin-sized mattress that covered the entire floor. When he asked to move in with me after our third date so his roommate could move his record collection out of the bathroom and back into storage, I decided we weren't going to make it as a long-term couple. I don't always meet guys in weird places, I state defensively. Tim was a blind date from work.
Wasn't he the adult braces guy?
Yes, I admit. I was hoping Jeremy had forgotten that tiny detail. I tried to overlook the mouthwear at first. Having a romantic partner who's conscientious about oral hygiene seemed like a selling point. I felt differently after I learned Tim was correcting a crooked tooth so he could fulfill his lifelong dream of booking a toothpaste commercial. I left before dessert, partly because I realized we were headed nowhere fast, and mostly because he'd already told me he wasn't eating any sugar per his orthodontist's strict instructions.
You know, I work with some really nice guys.
No, Jeremy. No. I repeat. I'll meet my own men. Thank you very much. He sighs. I don't know where the warn my friends away from my sister stereotype came from, but Jeremy stands in proud defiance of it. He loves to hype up not only his friends, but also his work colleagues to me every chance he gets. Jeremy works as a financial software analyst for some large corporation headquartered in Chicago. I have no idea what he actually does on a day-to-day basis because I've zoned out every single time he's explained it to me. Every single time. I don't think that bodes well for my compatibility with any of the men he works with. At least with Jeremy, I feel a sisterly sense of obligation to act like I'm listening. A quick glance down at the field reveals that everyone on it is still standing around. Why make the game last the single hour the 15-minute quarters add up to when you can have it last 3 hours instead? A rhetorical question, obviously. My phone vibrates with a text from my best friend Haley.
How is it?
Don't mention concession stand prices to Jeremy next time you see him.
Duly noted.
We've been best friends since preschool, so Haley has witnessed over 2 decades worth of Jeremy's strong opinions. Seconds later, she sends another text.
Guess who Laura saw last night?
A grainy photo comes through that I squint at. One of our good friends, Laura, works at an exclusive club downtown. Chicago isn't known for being a mecca of celebrity sightings. Most of the clientele the city's upscale establishments cater to are middle-aged workaholics looking to spend their obscene salary and pretend their hairline isn't receding. All I can tell about the guy in this photo is he's tall and has brown hair. It's obviously not Oprah, based on both appearance and location. I send back a series of question marks.
Ryan Hastings,
Haley replies. I roll my eyes as I shove my phone back in my pocket. No wonder today's offensive strategy seems to be not to have one. Someone clearly doesn't take his job seriously.
Looks like we'll be here a while longer.
I blow out a long breath following the understatement. I'm going to use the bathroom, I tell Jeremy. He nods, barely paying attention to me as he scrolls through something on his phone, probably checking his work email because the concept of a day off is foreign to him. I stand, stretch, because not only are these seats far enough away from the field to practically require binoculars, they're also super uncomfortable, and start down the steep stairs. Rather than use the restroom directly across the cement hallway, I amble along the popcorn-strewn, beer-stained ground at approximately the same speed as the game on the field is progressing. I'm not in any rush to return to my cramped chair. Coming to the Grizzlies' first home game of the season is an annual tradition. Growing up on the combined salaries of an associate professor and a construction worker in an expensive city, money was always tight. My dad would splurge once a year on the cheapest seats he could get and take Jeremy and me to a game, the same way he and his 2 brothers went with their father each year. It's a Willis family tradition, one I loved and looked forward to as a kid, one I dutifully kept up with throughout my teenage years and into adulthood, because there are far more unpleasant things I'd do for my father than sit through a football game. This past March, there was an equipment malfunction at the site he was working on, and the accident left him paralyzed from the waist down. He easily could have died, and seeing him in a wheelchair is nowhere near as horrifying as that possibility. In typical fashion, he's put on a brave face and made the best of the impairment, but I know today is the hardest day for him since the accident happened. His limited mobility means he's missing watching the opening game from Inglewood Stadium for the first time in his life. And it means Jeremy and I are sitting next to an empty seat because neither of us, even Mr. Money Saver himself, could stomach making the fiscally sound decision to sell the 3rd ticket that's been affixed to my parents' fridge for months. Some things matter more than money, even when it's tight. I stop at the next woman's room I come across. Although the televisions mounted every dozen feet along the hallway show that miraculously play has resumed, or maybe because of that, the line is out the door. Despite its length, the line moves fairly quickly. I emerge from one of the mostly clean stalls and head for an open sink. A petite woman with long chestnut-colored hair, we're talking shampoo commercial quality, appears at the one next to mine. I love your shirt, she tells me as she squirts some soap on her hands. I glance down at the plaid button-down I'm wearing. I tend to dress like I've just stepped out of the pages of a J. Crew catalog. Soft sweaters, cozy flannels, skinny jeans. Fall is my season, and I'm taking full advantage of the first glimmers of it finally breaking through what's been a typically humid Chicago summer. Thanks, I reply with a smile, eyeing her outfit. She's wearing a lightweight jacket with a distinctive plaid pattern that suggests it likely costs more than 2 months' rent in my small studio. "I have that shirt in green," she adds as we exit the bathroom. I don't usually engage in conversation with strangers I meet in the bathroom, but I go with it. She's rich, it appears, and I have an unfounded theory that rich people are less likely to be serial killers or stalkers. "Oh, I didn't know they make it in." I stop talking as soon as I see the man standing to the right of the exit. A man who, if not for the fact that I spent 4 months dating him, I would not have recognized.
"Embry."
He recognizes me immediately. I look the same. "Oliver," I reply. The woman wearing Burberry glances between us. "You two know each other?"
"You two know each other?"
I echo, looking back and forth between her and the guy I broke up with because dating an aspiring comedian meant always picking up the tab and everything, and I do mean everything, about our relationship being fair game during a bit. Oliver looks uncomfortable, and I do my best to act like I have no idea why.
"I'm not sure how the two of you met, but Melissa, this is Embry. Embry, this is my girlfriend, Melissa."
I don't miss how he neglects to share the ex-girlfriend-slash-sugar-mama title I paid for with my dignity and a few $100s. However, I am distracted as I study the knit sweater and dark jeans that have replaced the grungy t-shirts and holy sweatpants that were all I saw him wear during the entirety of our ill-fated relationship.
"I didn't know you were a football fan, Embry,"
Oliver continues. "I didn't know you owned clothes without holes in them," I reply. Oliver laughs. Melissa smiles, which tells me they haven't been dating long enough for her to hear the uncomfortable edge underneath the amusement. Or maybe she's simply a better actress than I am. I've never been good at acting like things are okay when they're not.
"Yeah, I guess I was really dressing the part for a while there,"
Oliver replies. "The part?" I don the same horrified expression Oliver would wear any time anyone disparaged his craft. "I take that to mean you're no longer attempting to make it as a comedian?" He laughs again, with pure amusement.
"God, no. Can you imagine? I decided it was time to face reality. Put that business degree to use."
"Degree? You told me you dropped out of school," I state, not bothering to curb the accusation in my voice.
"Yeah, law school. Business school was way easier. Only 2 years instead of three."
"I can't." To Oliver, I say, "You owe me several $100s, seeing as I bankrolled our entire relationship." To Melissa, I say, "Don't put your green shirt in the dryer, the fabric shrinks." Then, I head toward the nearest concession stand that sells beer. Once I'm 1642 poorer, freaking tax, alcohol after you encounter an ex is, in fact, a necessity, I head back to the direction of my section, pausing frequently to take long gulps of beer. I'm basically shotgunning it. But it's a preferable option than having to listen to any more commentary from Jeremy on 1, the cost of the beer, and 2, the fact that my dating track record is worse than the Cubs was pre-World Series win. I gulp the last of the alcohol right as I reach the cement tunnel that leads back out toward the field. It feels like I've been gone for hours, but in reality, the fourth quarter hasn't even started yet. 4 minutes remain in the third, which I can confidently state will take a minimum of 15 to tick away. I toss the can into a recycling bin and walk to the opening that leads to the sound and sunshine. Halfway there, a man holding a massive video camera, the type you see being held all around the field, zooming in on players' pleased or pissed off faces to heighten the drama, approaches me.
"Enjoying the game?"
he asks. The question is paired with an upbeat expression. My reply is blunt. "No." He quirks a brow, surprised, or more likely, as I realize when he hoists his camera, he's sniffing out a story. As a quasi-journalist, I should know. Unfortunately, recent events and my current blood alcohol content ensure I lay out my issues with the game. The uncomfortable seats, the overpriced food, and most importantly, the Grizzlies quarterback's poor excuse of a hungover performance in all colorful, detailed terms. Like I told Jeremy, I'm a fun drunk.
2. Embry. My life is a complete and utter disaster. I've thought that before. It's never been truer than this exact moment. January 25th, 2:04 p.m.
I'm sorry, Embry. You've done fantastic work here, really. It's just, we're on a tight budget. The last couple of issues haven't been performing as well as we'd hoped, specifically the arts section, also known as my section.
Right, I reply, emphasizing the final sound. Maybe it's bad form to employ sarcasm while speaking to your boss, but I feel like it becomes far more acceptable when he's just finished firing you.
I really am sorry,
Stephen tells me, pushing his wire-rimmed glasses further up his nose. He hates conflict. I'm surprised he didn't try to foist this unpleasant task off onto one of the junior editors, rather than having to can me himself.
I know you are, I sigh.
Truth is, I don't love working at Lemon, the Tribune's attempt to stay hip and relevant in the digital age. The hours were all right, and the pay was enough to pay rent. I was never excited about coming to work, though. The highlight of my time at this magazine was probably the opportunity to wear whatever I wanted to, because Jerry, the editor-in-chief before Stephen, endeavored to cultivate a casual atmosphere to avoid workplace conflict. Wearing jeans every day wasn't enough to keep Jerry from getting punched by Carrie's, the digital producer he was having an affair with, husband in the middle of our weekly staff meeting 3 weeks ago. As badly as I felt for Mr. Carey, it was most definitely the highlight of my tenure at this publication. Not loving my job is a perpetual problem for me. I never love working anywhere. I enjoy most jobs for the first couple of weeks, roughly the length of time it takes for the role to become comfortable, boring, predictable. Some people love their jobs for years, even decades, a concept I find as confusing as J-Lo's inability to age.
I'm happy to provide a reference, Stephen offers eagerly.
I guess I'm taking this better than he expected me to.
Whatever you need.
I need a job, Stephen, I say pointedly.
Yes, well,
he trails off awkwardly. Not on the table. I wonder if they're going to hire someone else to fill my position or just scrap it altogether. I decide I don't want to know. I sigh. I'll go pack up my cubicle.
Anything you take that was company issued will be deducted from your final paycheck, Stephen tells me.
I raise both eyebrows. Seriously? My expression must convey what I'm thinking because he apologizes. He has the good grace to look sheepish as well.
It's been an issue with former disgruntled employees,
he explains. That's me, disgruntled. And in that case, I should probably snag my Apple computer. That alone is probably worth more than my final paycheck. For a company looking to tighten the purse strings, Lemon was awfully generous with the technological budget. I slink back to my desk, not meeting any of the questioning glances aimed my way. Meetings in Stephen's office mean one of two things, a promotion or a firing, and duck behind the laminate wall that offers some measure of privacy. I stare sullenly at the half-finished email on the computer screen for a few minutes before I log out of my account and shut off the monitor. Almost 2 years working here and I barely decorated. My penchant for design closely aligns with my level of enthusiasm.
I stuff a framed photo of Jeremy, my dad, and me outside Inglewood Stadium at the last Grizzlies game we all attended together into my oversized tote bag, followed by a photo booth strip displaying my best friend Haley and me making ridiculous faces. All that's left is my "I survived another meeting that should have been an email" desk plate, and the collection of glittery pens I used to edit articles or jot down marketing ideas. In a minute act of rebellion, I snag my black company-issued stapler. If they want to dock me a few dollars for it, they can feel free. My exit is met with minimal pageantry. Most of the staff is in a sexual misconduct in the workplace seminar. I'm sure they're all silently thinking Jerry right about now. And the few who aren't are the make forced small talk in the kitchen sort of colleagues. I tell a couple of them I'll keep in touch. I probably won't. And exit the old mill building that's been converted into trendy offices, stepping out onto the bustling Chicago sidewalk. I debate my mode of transportation for a minute. L or Uber? Considering my current unemployed state, I should opt for the cheaper option. Uber it is. I'll scrimp starting tomorrow. I pull my phone out of my pocket. It rings before I have a chance to unlock it. Hey! I inject as much cheer into the greeting as my just-fired individual can muster.
Hi, Embry. You have a minute?
Anderson, my boyfriend of 15 days, asks. Of course, I reply. If he only knew how many I suddenly have. As of about 20 minutes ago, my future is nothing but a blank canvas.
There's a no great way to say this.
Unease trickles down my spine. Good news never follows that statement.
So I'm just going to say it. I think we should end things between us.
Oh? Shock keeps any other emotion from bleeding into my voice. It's not even a word. Just a surprised sound.
You're a great girl. I've really enjoyed getting to know you. It's just... I got offered a big promotion. I'm moving to London in 2 weeks, and a long-distance relationship just doesn't appeal to me right now.
Oh, I say again. Vaguely, I wonder if I should ask him if they're hiring someone to fill his old position. I decide I'm not that desperate. Yet. Hello, rock bottom. Horrible to hit you. I've just been dumped and fired in the span of time it usually takes me to order takeout. Anderson keeps talking, saying how this is such a great opportunity and how he doesn't see our relationship going anywhere after he moves.
Isn't it better just to end things now?
He asks. I find myself agreeing. When your life lights up like a dumpster fire, sometimes it's more appealing to pour on gasoline than water. My phone begins buzzing. It takes me a solid 10 seconds to talk my arm into rising and reaching for the vibrating device. I don't even glance at the screen before answering. Hello? I whisper as I jab at the remote to pause the television.
Embry?
Haley's voice comes through the line.
What's wrong?
I'm in mourning. I take a long sip from my half-empty glass, then burp. Excuse me.
What happened?
Haley sounds concerned, but not as worried as anyone but my best friend might sound. I have a flair for the dramatics, mostly attributable to my middle school fantasy of becoming a famous actress. Haley has seen the My Life is a Mess movie starring me before. Oh, nothing much. I keep my tone airy.
You're just talking to the unemployed, soon to be broke, and newly single Embry Willis tonight.
Haley swears. You're lying on the couch drinking tequila and watching Gilmore Girls, aren't you?
No,
I reply petulantly.
I moved on to Schitt's Creek an hour ago, and I think I should move to Canada. Guys seem loyal and likely to stay in one place there, like Ted. Why can't I meet a Ted? Do you know any veterinarians? Maybe I should get a dog. Or maybe a bunny, and then I can...
I'm coming over, Haley hangs up. I snuggle back into the couch.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?